morning, everybody. It's Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you with us. We spend this first hour looking at this national race and what we've seen about it. I want to start off by saying that two things that struck me over the last day before we start our conversation with Julianne Hing for the first part of our program. One is yesterday, of course, was the anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X that we covered pretty thoroughly here and do often. And the other is Albert Woodfox was released from prison in Louisiana after 40 years in solitary, Angola 3. And so we have been talking to his folks, hoping to have a conversation with him in the next few days here on the Mark Steiner Show, and just also to celebrate the fact that he is free and has been able to walk out as a free man after all that time in solitary. When you think about that, what that really means, 40 years in solitary confinement. So we just want to mention that. And also here in Baltimore, the people around him helped create one of the exhibits at the American Visionary Art Museum, the Angola 3 room that was created there with a vision of the house he wanted to build if he got free. All that's there as well, and some of those folks will be coming to Baltimore to celebrate that as well. So we'll keep you abreast of all of that. We begin today, the first few minutes of our program, talking with Julianne Hing, who's been covering the 2016 elections from the perspective of immigrant communities and communities of color for Nation magazine. Previously, she covered immigration, education, and police accountability for Color Lines and joins us now. Julianne, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
How are you?
Well, it's early still out here in Las Vegas, and it's been an intense phase, and there's more to come with the GOP.
So, yeah, talk a bit about what you see in the GOP coming up, and then I have one other question for you about that.
Well, so, you know, hot on the heels of South Carolina, lots of candidates are just getting into town, and you know, it's really interesting to see where their bases of support are. For instance, Ted Cruz is doing almost a dozen events up and down the state in the next 36 hours. But there, you know, he's leaving Las Vegas, which is one of the population centers of Nevada, and heading up into the rural parts of Nevada, up to Carson City, Elko, towns like Minden. And last night, Marco Rubio returned home. You know, as many folks know, Marco Rubio lived with his family as a child for a short time in Las Vegas and spoke to a ballroom of supporters at a casino called Texas Station last night. And really...
Are you still there? Did we lose Julianne? Hi, Julianne. I think we got you back. Julianne? Something just went dead. So, folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And let's give it a second here. If they get Julianne back on, if not, we'll turn to our guest here in the studio to pick up. And if Julianne comes back on, we'll bring her back into this conversation at 410-319-8888. Hi, Julianne, you there?
I am.
Okay, sorry, go ahead. You were saying.
Well, so Marco Rubio spoke to a really packed ballroom, and among the people in the ballroom were many folks who might have supported Jeb Bush, many Republicans who are completely disgusted by Donald Trump and are looking for a more palatable alternative. And you know, one might think that given the fact that it's the Republican Party, it would have been a lily white and very senior citizen kind of turnout, which, you know, in many respects it was. But there were a fair number of people of color in the ballroom, and Tuesday should be a pretty interesting race now that there are, you know, just about. Now that the GOP field is winnowing.
So what do you mean by a fair number of people of color, and who and what do they represent? What does that mean?
Right. Well, I could only speak to the folks that I could speak to. They didn't take exit polls at last night's event. I didn't see any person who was African-American at all last night. I saw several, more than a handful, and I saw and spoke to more than a handful of folks who are either Puerto Rican or Cuban or Mexican. I spoke to more than a handful of folks who are Filipino. I think that it suggests that Marco Rubio's message speaks to more than just the stereotypical image of a GOP voter.
So tell me what all this for you before we turn to our panel here in the studio portends for the future of this election, especially with the Latino communities, the various Latino communities.
Right. I will say that I do think that Nevada, I do think that Marco Rubio is a surprisingly effective campaigner who has a powerful, despite all the media reports of his robotic nature, has actually a very compelling personal story and has been able to capture the attention of people who are so repulsed by Donald Trump and the Democrats at the same time. I think that whoever the nominee is on the Democrat side, Marco Rubio will be a real threat.
Well, I really do appreciate the time you took this morning, Julianne. Thanks. I know it's early where you are, and I look forward to talking to you again really soon for a much longer time as this election unfolds. I really do enjoy your writing a great deal.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Take care. Julianne Hing, covering the 2016 election for Nation magazine from the perspective of immigrant communities in our country. We turn now to our panel in studio here. Jessel Noor is with us, reporter and producer of the Real News Network. Good to have you back, Jess.
Thanks for having me on.
Eugene Craig III is with us, grassroots activist, third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party. Good to have
appreciate you back, Eugene.
Dr. Tara Bynum is with us, postdoctoral fellow in the English Department at Rutgers University. Good to have you in studio, Tara. Welcome.
Good to be here.
And y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. But do join us again, 410-319-8888. Before we went on the air, Justin and I were talking a little bit about what we were going to talk about. And one of the things that really strikes me about this election, and just get your thoughts on this and what it might mean, is there were two factors here. The Bernie Sanders factor I'll come to in a minute. But Donald Trump. I remember in the very beginning of these conversations we had months and months and months back, even at one of our Center for Emerging Media board meetings before the race got hot, there were some people in our meeting going, watch Donald Trump. Don't discount Donald Trump. He's going to explode. And we all went, yeah, that. He says, you know, he's a moron. How is he going to explode? He's a clown. So a lot of us looked at him as a clown, right? And as somebody who was a celebrity and really had some really hard records in terms of his business and everything else, ventures in this country. But I think that Democrats and even some Republicans, depending on who they like or don't like, would do well not to minimize what this could mean for our country if Donald Trump actually begins winning primaries as he goes across the nation. So let me ask one different. So you've been covering this pretty intensely, Jessel. Then go to get a Republican perspective and come on to Tara.
Well, I think there's a couple different factors at play. One, obviously, Trump is a household figure. He's been on TV sets all over the country, so people are familiar with him. He's also independently wealthy. So I think the same message that kind of resonates with Sanders supporters that money is corrupting politics, you know, Trump can say, I don't need other people's money. I don't need other rich people's money. I have my own money. So I'm not going to be influenced by these outside actors. You know, he, as we've all seen on the debate stage, he's been able to poke holes in some of the things that the Republican establishment kind of stands for and defends. Like, for example, the Iraq War, which I think many Americans, if not in 2002 and 2003, now they kind of see the disaster of it. And he was up there attacking Bush, who now has dropped out,
right,
and you saw the other, many of the other candidates defending the Iraq War, and you see the effects it's had in the Middle East, the rise of ISIS, the effects on the veterans at home, and so I think a lot of Americans are, you know, tired of hearing people defend the Iraq War. I think another factor is the media coverage, and the media has been all over Trump. There was one report in 2015, Trump got 234 minutes of primetime media stories just on him. And Bernie Sanders got 68. Like ABC News, they spent five times the amount of time covering Joe Biden's decision not to run than they gave to Sanders' entire campaign in 2015. So I think the media coverage is definitely factoring into that.
That's really interesting about the media. We need to come back to that issue. Yeah. That's something people don't talk about enough in terms of how it affects how people think. Gene.
I think the Trump phenomenon is here and is here to stay. I have a slightly different perspective on it. You know, I you know, I personally hold the perspective that we're going to get to Cleveland without a nominee. I don't think if the
you're
race.
You're saying weird because you're an activist in the Republican Party. Just
I'm a,
that,
you know,
right.
One of the vice chairs in the Maryland Republican Party. But, you know, I think we get to, you know, we Republicans get to Cleveland without a nominee. I don't think anybody wins a state, including Donald Trump. But I do think it was a miscalculation to underscore him. I think it was a miscalculation to think it was a miscalculation of the environment, the political environment that we're in. We're by normal rules, you know, you should probably see a Jeb Bush or a Scott Walker thriving right now. But these aren't normal rules, and the rules are forever changing. So I think Donald Trump is here to stay, but I also don't see where he, you know, picks up a majority win in any state.
Tara.
Trump has always been of great concern to me because he is, because of his celebrity. I think his celebrity and his ability to use that celebrity to say what's on his mind without fear of recourse. And I think that that kind of disavowal of political correctness certainly is part of what makes him attractive to the masses. You know, he appears to be a man who can say what's on his mind. I also think that there's a society has started to privilege the businessman as the smartest in the room. You know, I think about the way that ed policy is moving towards folks that have MBAs.
Education policy, I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So I think that there's a way in which we believe that if you have been a CEO or you've been in business that you know how to run something. And I'm not entirely sure that's always true. There's many examples to the contrary. But I think that belief in the businessman as the epitome of success is ultimately, too, what's helping Trump.
And I think, just for argument's sake, if Trump was to get the nomination for the Republican Party, I think, again, Democrats, some people look at this as well, that would be an easy victory then for...
Oh, absolutely not. I think Donald
Trump...
Democrats,
as people are saying inside the Republican primary right now, that they count up all the votes that are not for Trump, assuming that that means that they would all go to either Cruz or Rubio. And I think they're both probably false.
Right. And in the Republican primaries and the caucuses, it's winner takes all, right? So if Trump is winning South Carolina, he's going to get those delegates.
Well,
right?
No.
He did win those delegates in South Carolina.
Yeah, well, he won the majority of delegates in South Carolina. But up until March 15th, everything's proportional.
Okay.
But even with the winner take all states, there's a very, 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 very slight rule within the RNC bylaws for this next upcoming convention. That you have to win a majority, 50% plus one in a state for that state to put you up for nomination. As long as we have three people, maybe four or five, because I don't see Kasich or Carson getting knocked anytime soon, nobody's going to have their name placed up for nomination where, you know, we get to a convention where nobody's bound to any candidate, and it's literally a free fall on the convention floor.
Yeah, I mean, in a general election, how do you think a candidate's going to fare that – where you go to his rallies and there's the first thing you hear is a warning not to beat people up, not to beat up protesters, you know, and you know, because you've seen Sikh Americans, Muslim Americans, just try to even like have silent protests, and you've seen them attacked and brutalized. You've seen a number of attacks against minorities around the country that have been linked to Trump's rhetoric, you know, anti-Muslim, anti-minority rhetoric.
Right.
So how is he going to fare in a general? I think he has a lot of, you know, baggage coming in.
Well,
a lot of baggage.
I think he triangulates and modulates like everybody else. You know, one thing I've been saying is that I think Donald Trump may be the greatest finesser in the world. I think the closer he gets to the nomination, the more you're going to see his language, you know, moderate towards the middle. I think he would be a formidable general election candidate. I think any of our candidates is, you know, 100 times better than Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton.
Well, I mean, but in a nonpartisan perspective, I mean, his attacks, his personalized attacks, his sexist attacks, his racist attacks on people. I think he can't help himself in terms of how he responds, and that doesn't bode him well in a general election.
And he also knows what knows what white America wants to hear. He wants to know what their desires are and, you know, make America great again. Like when, like 1950s during segregation, during Jim Crow, during slavery, like what? So he had, I mean, has he spoken about what exactly, what period he wants to go back to in time?
Well, I think he wants to, you know, and this is, I'm in an awkward position here defending Donald Trump. but, you know, I from my understanding, for the record, I was a Rand Paul guy. He wants to make America great again. I think that's a sentiment that you see on both sides of the aisle. That's the way he verbalized it. But I think there's an argument that can be made if you look at, you know, the Bernie Sanders movement, people feeling slighted by the economy, people feeling slighted by the higher education system. I think those could be, interpreted as symptoms of America not being the great country that, we're used to America being.
Yeah, and what makes Sanders' campaign unique is that he's actually calling out who many people would agree are the cause of these problems, right? He's actually saying that it's the elite class that has led us to this financial ruin, this struggling economy, a lack of jobs. So one thing that Trump and Sanders agree on are the free trade deals, right? And the loss of millions of jobs through NAFTA and other policies like that.
Yeah, I think that but I guess what I think is interesting about Trump and Trump's ability to kind of garner widespread support is that he, on the one hand, it's the elites that are benefiting more than the vast majority of other people. But I think that part of the American dream is the possibility that we can all get to be a Donald Trump one day. So, yes, there's a demographic that will never be Donald Trump, is not in the position to be Donald Trump or to live that American dream. But Donald Trump represents the possibility. And I think that that demographic has to be acknowledged in some way as being part of who Donald Trump can paint a beautiful American dream for. Like, look, you can get there, too. Look at me.
Except, I mean, if I was running the media campaign against Donald Trump, I mean, that would leave me a lot of fodder from, yes.
Of course, that's the hope.
Right? That, yes. If your dad was like mine and left me $1 million, I could start a business as well. And then the numbers of businesses that have just bellied up under Trump. I mean, there's a lot of things they could do they're actually not doing. It's almost as if people are afraid to attack Trump.
Well, I think, I mean, if anyone takes polls seriously, what's interesting is that Sanders is beating all the Republican candidates at a much wider margin than Clinton is right now.
In the Trump, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think some of the, there is that some appeal, and, you know, we know Sanders has, it's young white voters that are his main base, and it's, you know, Trump also has new voters that, you know, wouldn't vote or haven't voted before that are appealing to him.
And you said Sanders. Let me open the phones right after this. And Jeffrey, you're the first caller up. Is that Sanders is really, in a very straight political sense, without kind of a depth analysis for a moment of economic and political stances, has tripped up a lot and fallen and stumbled a bit over the last several weeks. Whether it was at the an African American forum that was held in Minneapolis, where he was. Challenged by a woman on the panel who was African-American and apparently an artist from Minneapolis. I forgot her name. I apologize. But she challenged him on the use of the word, and he was challenged to use the word black. And he tried to, as he does, interrupts, said, whoa, 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 whoa. And then she said, you let me finish what I'm saying. And then as she was speaking, he was holding to his mic going, hitting the top of his mic as I just did during the whole time she was speaking. So that happened. And there are other instances like that. That have kind of – he's gotten some blowback and also just not being prepared on foreign policy or responding to his 2012 saying that Obama should have been challenged without – he had a chance to really explain that but didn't. So he stumbled a lot, I think, Jessel, in the last few weeks.
Yeah, I think it's been overall, I mean, even when he stumbles, that's a good thing for Sanders because it means he's in the news, which wasn't happening before, right? So people are going to hear his message. I think on foreign policy there are some, you know, that's been one of the big criticisms of him. He hasn't kind of really laid out what his plans are for foreign policy. I think a lot of people on the left would criticize his plan to fight ISIS, which is to get Saudi Arabia more involved, which is, you know, one of the most dangerous and backwards countries, the most extreme countries in the Middle East that's been, you know, known to be exporting terrorism. They were named in the 9/11 report as, you know, aiding the attackers. But, you know, I think he did seize an opportunity in that last debate when he called out Hillary Clinton's friendship with Henry Kissinger. He spoke about the U.S. coup of the democratically elected prime minister of Iran in 1953, Mossadegh,
right.
As the roots of why Iran, you know, why we're at odds with Iran more than 60 years later. So he has won some major points, I think. But yeah, so now the spotlight, now the focus is on him more. So now he's getting this attention he didn't have before. So I think, you know, he's faced some challenges there.
Tara?
I guess I am utterly fascinated by the effect of the media attention. You know, I was listening to something that said that, you know, when Michael Jordan was playing, they had a separate camera to watch Michael Jordan at all times just in case he did something. And it sounds like there's a Trump camera. Like, we just watch Trump because he's going to say something that's going to get us the ratings
good
that
for
we
ratings,
need. Yeah. And I think I guess it just adds another layer to how complicated this presidential election is and how much the media shapes the narrative and who it is that we attend to.
Just think about it this way. Yeah, I think there's one incident that could define the entire Trump run. Go back to his announcement. Work with the gentleman that worked with him and got him geared up for his exploratory right now. His announcement was supposed to last all of 12 minutes. I had everybody there in Trump Tower. He came down on the escalator and, you know, came out, you know, gave the whole camera running for president. And then, you know, all hell breaks loose. You know, as the outro music is playing, he tells them, cut the music, and then goes on for another 40 minutes. It was right then and there that the media decided, okay, we're going to cover this, you know, as the phenomenon that it is. And I think, you know, the media has played a very intricate role in and creating this beast that we know to be Donald Trump in the Republican primary.
So, again, a political question before we get into some substance about where this might take America and what this divide really means, which I want to get into in the next half hour. Do we think on the Republican side that Rubio and Cruz have a chance of winning this nomination? Kasich's holding in there for a while, but I don't know how much longer he can really hold in unless he kind of picks up his vote. And Carson as well, obviously. On the other hand, and the Democratic side, do we really think Hillary's not going to get the nomination?
Well, you know, I'd like to hear a you know, defense or a defense of Cruz and where and what he stands for versus Trump, because, you know, for people on the left, they all seem very extreme. And I know Robert Reich, who was Under Secretary of Education under Clinton, he actually said a Cruz presidency scares him more than a Trump presidency.
I mean, Secretary of Labor under
Secretary of Labor, right. Clinton. He, because of Trump's ideological positions that make him more extreme. Rubio is trying to set himself apart on foreign policy, and he supports ending the Iran nuclear deal and keeping Cuba keeping the sanctions on Cuba. So, like, where is the wisdom on that? You know,
policy wise, I'm not sure there's a huge piece of difference between the three candidates, other than maybe on immigration.
Yeah,
not even on immigration, really. Not at all.
Yeah, the only two that were kind of talking more moderately about immigration and how to treat undocumented people in this country, Kasich and Bush. Our, you know, Bush is out and Kasich is sidelined.
So take us quickly to break, then we're going to come
right
back.
All right, no problem. I do think all five current candidates have a shot at the nomination. It's going to come down to what happens when we get to Cleveland.
Carson has a shot at the
nomination. I think Carson has a shot at the nomination right now as it stands. And that's a stretch, but yeah. As it stands right now, you know, he has a shot at the nomination. I think, you know, any of our five, I said earlier, any of our five is better than a candidate that's currently under investigation by the FBI and another one that's about socialists.
I'm not sure. But that's, you know, kind of, I understand the partisan view of that.
You know.
I would say in a more objective sense that either one of those candidates has a real shot at winning, as does one of the Republican candidates, depending on who their ticket is. I think this is a very tough race in coming up for America.
It's going to be full of surprises.
It is.
Yeah,
we have to get a very brief break. We'll come right back. Jeffrey, the first caller up at 410-319-8888. We'll be back with Eugene Craig, Tara Bynum, and Jessel Knorr. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way back to conversation, I will remind you the WEA, the voice of the community, is working for you. Join us in conjunction with the City Paper, the Afro, and Spokesman as we present the 2016 Baltimore mayoral debate, bringing together the candidates so that you can hear directly from them. The event is open to the public, but seats are going fast. RSVP today, baltimoremayoraldebate.eventbrite.com for the debate taking place here at Morgan State University on March the 10th. We are here with Jessel Knorr, who is reporter and producer for The Real News Network, Eugene Craig III, grassroots activist, third vice chair of the Maryland State Republican Party, Dr. Tara Bynum, postdoctoral fellow at the English Department at Rutgers University, and you at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on this election, who you would be supporting or not, and why, what you think the major issues are for you. Write to us here at talk at steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888 is a number to call. And Jeffrey, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Jeffrey, you there?
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
We can. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much for your great panelists and for Mark Gunnery, too, and your whole team. I just really appreciate you guys so much.
Thank you.
So I've got all of this written on one of those really tiny Post-it notes. I've got them numbered through six, actually, here.
Well, I don't know if we can go through all six. Let's see what you can do.
I know, but touch on as many as you can, honestly. Climate change was never mentioned by anybody except for Bernie Sanders, I don't think, nor has public campaign financing. If we don't get Sheldon Adelson and Karl Rove and Citizens United and K Street out of Washington, we will always have the best government that corporations can buy, and that's pretty much the definition of fascism, I think, when corporations run a country. I think that's part of the definition of fascism. But anyway, the number three is human or wise Scalia. Oh, humane. If anybody could mention a humane or bit of wisdom that Scalia put forth, I would love to know about it. And I thought it was really disgusting how they were parsing whether or not Obama went to the cathedral versus his funeral or whatever. There was just so much hubbub. It's kind of like whether he had an American flag on his lapel or not, I thought. Anyway, but if someone could mention something of Scalia, and then corporations able to sue the United States under the free trade agreement, I think, and get rid of EPA and climate and probably labor regulations in the United States is just so shocking. And I think that would relate to Clinton and Obama. And I'm hoping maybe Mark will help me figure out whether I should be voting for Clinton and or Bernie Sanders. I don't think either of them will be able to accomplish anything more than President Obama's been able to do if we have Mitch McConnell running the Senate and millionaires running the Congress. Anyway,
all right, those are really good points. Let's hit them. I mean, I think climate change has not been a major factor in this debate so far. I think he will become in the general.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as the caller said, you know, Sanders has been the only candidate that's really talked about how to address the greatest threat humanity's ever faced when majority Republicans are still in denial that it exists, when like 99% of all scientists say this is a real, you know, say this is real. It's already impacting low-lying island countries all over the world. Issue of campaign finance. You know, Sanders wants to get all money out of politics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Clinton wants to get rid of Citizens United, which is the dark money, you know, which is the dark money pouring into super PACs. But she's still, I mean, she's a corporate candidate, so she still wants money. She still wants to be able to raise money from Wall Street. She still wants, that's how, you know, she gets lots of her money. Versus Sanders, whose average donation is something like $27. And which is, you know, which if he can, the fact that he is a serious candidate shows that people, he's got 3.7 million individual contributions already. I think that it's a sign that people are willing to put their money where their mouths are and support a candidate who's going to be beholden to the people versus, you know, special interests.
I mean, to me, that's one of the reasons this election can be so confusing for people as it goes down to the general election. Is climate change, which I think will become a big issue in the general election. I think that's going to be a huge fight over there. Interesting, total aside, but I was reading an article yesterday, about how there are all these small city and town Republican mayors in northwest of the United States who are talking about climate change, which I think is really interesting.
When they're facing the reality of it,
they have to deal with it. The public financing, I think he mentioned Scalia. And I think that this it's always been a subtext to an election. This year it might be more front and center just because of the battle over his replacement. I mean, I think that, and that becomes a huge ideological battle. So I think these things – and TPP, if Clinton is the nominee – and you have a Republican, say, opposed to TPP, and you have a Democrat for TPP.
Well, Clinton has now come out against TPP.
I mean, that's a flip-flop.
Yeah. Well, she changed her position. I mean, a lot of her position, she's had to come out more on the left after Sanders became a more serious candidate.
Right, exactly.
And she's changed her entire platform. All her rhetoric is, you know, everything she's saying in her speeches – opening statements and debates, she's responding. It sounds like she's responding to what Sanders is saying.
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think that's correct.
Well,
Tara,
you know, I think climate change is still a niche issue to a large degree.
Niche issue?
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe with some old white Republicans.
I think with the broader electorate, I don't think there's going to be, you know, many folks that are going to go into the voting booth and say, you know what, I'm voting strictly based off climate, off what this candidate stands for on climate change. When it comes to campaign finance, you know, I think Citizens United is an amazing thing. I think, you know, the work that Dave Bossi does with CU is amazing work. I think
– So you support the decision?
Oh, absolutely. I feel as though you should be able to give whatever the hell you want, and as long as it's reported within 24, 48 hours.
But the dark money isn't reported. You don't have to disclose, you know, how that money's spent or who's giving it. So it's not even disclosed, right?
Well, I mean, you know, when it comes to super PACs, I think everybody on all sides of the aisle use them.
Except for Bernie Sanders.
Well,
right.
Except for Bernie Sanders. But, you know, I think, you know, both Democrats and Republicans use them. And I do think political giving is free speech. And, you know, we would not reasonably expect, you know, the FCC to come in and tell us what we can say on air that it kind of do. So I don't think it should be reasonable to have the FCC come and tell a person what they can give to a candidate. And so it's free speech. It's free speech, and I think it shouldn't be limited.
Well, I mean, I think the difference between that and free speech is that it just means wealthy people have more of it, right? So it's free for the super rich, but then if you're just an average voter, your average citizen, then your voice means, you know, your voice and what you care about is irrelevant.
That's not necessarily true. You know, it's about access to the candidate. It's about, you know, the average voter can do things that a wealthy person couldn't do.
What?
Organize. I mean, you're not going to see a typical wealthy person come in and organize a town.
No, they just pay a lot of people to do it.
Not necessarily.
What do you mean? That's what they do.
You look at this election cycle. I mean, the two folks that have spent the most money on both sides of the aisle, Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, and where has it gotten them? I mean, Jeb Bush spent $150 million, you know, $115
million. But I mean, Hillary Clinton is winning.
Well,
she's not losing.
I think it's the argument made that she's losing. I mean, if you are being crowned the Democratic nominee for the last year and a half, and you have somebody like Bernie Sanders that's pretty much staying neck and neck with you, when, you know, for the last year and a half, 2 years, it's pretty much been a foregone conclusion that you're the Democrat nominee. I think that's a technical loss when you should be running the table in these contests.
Yeah, and she's been forced to start spending her super PAC money.
That's the time
she was reserving for the general election. She's already started using that now in the primary.
Tara?
Well, you know, it's interesting to hear you all speak in terms of what is ultimately a value. You know, if access is connected to money, like then it is not entirely equal. You know, like there's something that I'm not quite understanding, because I think that as soon as ideas or thoughts actually have a dollar amount attached, and you can pay a certain amount and presumably get the access that you're talking about. There's something highly problematic in that, if only because there are people who will only have $27 and not a million. So if the $1 million is more valuable than 27, and that's true, right? $1 million is more valuable than 27. Like, it just seems to me that there is a clear inequity there.
Yeah, it's very
well,
clear.
I think it comes down to the quality of the candidate. You can have a person like a Hillary Clinton that, you know, will take $1 million from this person, take $1 million from that person, switch their position every single time. Or you can come across a person like a Rand Paul or Ron Paul or Bernie Sanders, and yes, I am making the cardinal sin of comparing Ron Paul to Bernie Sanders. That could take $1 or $1 million and not switch their positions. I think it ultimately comes down to the quality of the candidate that you're supporting.
Except that the issue here, I think people are concerned about, is the fact that money that does not have to be accounted for is in the elections because of Citizens United, that they organize, like groups like ALEC and other places around the country, organize to change public policy and can use any amount of money they want to change that public policy, not be seen. I mean, that's a real danger in our society. And I think there are a lot of people on Republican or Democrat are really concerned about this. I think that remember what you look at the polls, I think that's going to be a clear piece. I think that's going to end along with TPP. I think these are things that are going to affect the general election in a deep way. And there's also questions, I think, that – go ahead.
And I guess I was going to ask a clarifying question. It's not just about the candidate changing their position. That money could then be used to create advertising that could change the people's position, right? So I think that also is of great concern. You might have a morally on-point candidate, but if you can change the perception of the masses, then the candidate may be in a better position to create or generate their own ideas in relation to it. You know, I think that's tricky, too.
I think we have a simple solution for it. If campaign finance becomes a serious issue in 2017 in Congress, simple solution. You know, unlimited political contributions, personal political contributions with a 24-hour, 48-hour disclosure.
Jessel?
I mean, so we're going to go back to the Gilded Age, like the 1920s, when, you know, corporations dominated everything, like unregulated markets where millions of people are impoverished. There's no, you know, health and safety guidelines. There's no pollution controls. That's the world that we're going to see if something like that happens, right?
I mean, look what just happened in California, where the majority of people wanted to have the limits put on oil and gas in cars in terms of and moving towards hybrid cars and moving away from where cars are now. And then all of a sudden, ExxonMobil and their PACs come in, spend millions of dollars, and switch the vote around in the state legislature. I mean, that's what we're talking about. The power of corporations are dominating America. I think whether you're Republican or Democrat, that's one of the reasons Trump, in all its weirdness, is so far ahead with this. And why Bernie Sanders is catching on partially is because people are fed up with the power of wealth in America.
And so I was in New Hampshire. I was talking to Sanders supporters. I was talking to Clinton supporters and Republicans that were at the Sanders rally. And I think, I've been talking to Sanders supporters all over the country. That is that is his basic message he stuck to this whole campaign, and that is what resonates with people around the country. That it's obvious, and that it hasn't been said before in politics, that corporations, the wealthy people, run our system, and they've been running it into the ground. You know, it hasn't been equal opportunity for all. The majority of the wealth created since the recession and the crash has gone to the most wealthy. And you see the state of Black America, you see poverty rates in this country, you see the state of public education in this country, especially in poor communities. Corporations aren't going to fix that. Like, who's going to fix that? It's not the government.
Let me throw another wrinkle in here, another part of the question here. And we talk about that and what Bernie Sanders has been saying and what other people have been saying in this race around those issues. But the issue of race and class are big in this election, huge. You're seeing in the Democratic primary especially. I mean, the majority of most of the Latino vote, by that I mean votes of Mexican-Americans and Puerto Ricans-Americans and on the Democratic side, are split in some ways between Sanders and and Clinton. And the battle over the African-American vote in these primaries is huge.
Yep.
And I think this is where the intersectional class race gets murky for people. And I think that people are having a hard time parsing this out and could have a deep effect on this general election for the Democrats. So your thoughts, Tara, and then Jesselyn, then we'll open the phones again.
There's so many thoughts. I do think that the issue of race and class is kind of critically important. I think about the way that kind of the Black Lives Matter protesters have kind of directly confronted Clinton and Sanders on their issues or related issues, and kind of the way that Clinton and Sanders in particular have, I guess, attempted to respond and sometimes, or most times, maybe not succeeded. So yeah, I definitely think that there are real concerns connected to race and class, and I can't quite get a handle on whether or not their responses
and probably
make
worth
sense.
Worth mentioning that Black Lives Matter protesters get dragged out of Trump rallies.
Right.
Probably worth mentioning in the same breath. I think it's been interesting because we've seen the for example, the Congressional Black Caucus Political Action Committee come out in support of Hillary Clinton. Despite the policies that, the Crime Bill of 94, all the policies that Bill Clinton pushed, I think Michelle Alexander had one of the most damning pieces about Hillary Clinton.
In the nation,
and it was not an endorsement of Bernie Sanders. But going into what Clinton's record has been for Black America, and the piece was entitled, I believe, "Why Black America Should Not Vote for Hillary Clinton."
Right, I read that.
But at the same time, you have rappers like Killer Mike, going out for Bernie, not saying he's a perfect candidate, criticizing him for not supporting things like reparations, which I think he's had to, that's been an issue with him. But at the same time, we've seen the Black elite essentially go to Clinton's side, and it might because she's the establishment candidate, she's more likely to win. But it goes to see we're still have to but that could be the deciding vote, especially in the South, going up to Super Tuesday, where 800 of the something like 2,300 necessary delegates will be awarded, and so that is going to be a big factor. Another factor is going to be the unpledged superdelegates,
yeah.
Which can go any way, and they're about 11% of the total delegates, and they could. Right now, the delegate toll is exactly tied, I believe, at 51 each. But going into the convention in July in Philadelphia, if it is close or if it's a tie, the superdelegates are going to decide.
And they're going to go for Hillary.
Yeah, the vast majority have already pledged to Hillary.
I think the superdelegates on either side are going to go for whatever they think the establishment candidate is at that moment. Let me go to the phones here. One of the things I was always hoping Bernie would say during his reparations, all he had to say was, and he didn't say it for whatever reason, he gets really flustered easily, I think. but it was to say, I support Kanye's bill. We should examine this as a nation and see where we go. At the very least.
Yeah.
But he
H.R. 40.
Right. He couldn't even say that. So that, I mean, that was a real problem, I think, on his part. 410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Mark. Mike Stout, Equity Matters.
Good morning.
Morning. It seems to me that we're talking about gaps, right? I think our country is headed to a place where we can't just fake stuff anymore, right? We can't use the old party line and a Bush can't make it through a primary. We can't pretend that we really have market solutions that work for public orientations. I mean, it's a crazy Ayn Rand argument, and we don't even really have true capitalism. It's ersatz capitalism, and if we looked at capitalism, we'd have to look at that book 000, who argues, well, if you want to look at free markets, you got to look at the narcotics markets, the only true free capital market in the world. And so we need to be able to look at stuff for what it is, and even with our elites and the electorate. The way that our electoral system works doesn't really represent us in a technologically relevant age. So my point is that we're moving from this old authoritative approach to leadership to an adaptive one where we have to change how we're thinking about solving our problems because the gaps are too big and we just can't keep ignoring. And I think that's what you're seeing with Black Lives Matter. That's what you're seeing with some of the traditional politicians not being able to get through primaries. And folks are going to have to be accountable because, you know, even if it's the party line to fall in rank behind the candidate that's the establishment, if the rank and file are feeling pain in new ways, that's not going to be sustainable either. So I just think we're in a different era, and it's going to be exciting over the next few years to see who can shift to from an authoritative approach to an adaptive one.
And what we could be seeing is the beginning of the end of both Democratic and Republican parties. If we go into these conventions and, a candidate is chosen, not elected, as you've predicted already, on the Republican side, that might happen on the Democratic side. We could be seeing these two parties in the beginning of the end. We could see a repeat of 68 in the streets of Philadelphia or the streets of Cleveland.
And you also could see in this election, as I said before, is this is a very interesting, I mean, could be a earth-shattering year in terms of American politics.
Mm-hmm. Already has been, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that, I know what you said during break, Gene, about Trump will not run third party. I'm not so sanguine about that. But if he did, let's say, and if then Bloomberg jumps in the race because Sanders is...
That's the only way it works.
Sanders is the nominee. Then you have 1860.
Yeah.
Nice.
When America was falling apart, and you had four parties representing the different aspects of why America was falling apart.
Did they have a duel to settle that or something?
Because of Civil War.
Yeah, I was going to say, they had one in less than 5 years.
And so I think that's not an... And I think when you're looking at what's going on here, you've got Latinos who make up roughly 17% or so of the American population, and then Latino means seven different things, right? Seven different groups of people in this country, really, majority of whom lean Democrat, but some lean Republican, like the Cuban-American community. Even there, they're split now. And African-Americans are 12.5% of the population of this country, and Democrats rely heavily on that and on the 30% of the white vote that doesn't vote Republican in this country, 25-30% of the white vote that does not vote Republican. So this election, that's why it's so difficult, because I think in many ways issues of communities of color, especially the African American community, have kind of leapt to the forefront of America in this debate in the last 15 years, and they're going to be paramount in how that plays out in this kind of very divided population in America. So this is a really very volatile year. More so than I think 2008 and 12 were, because every year's of hope, because you had a black American candidate that people put their hope in, at least people who voted Democratic. That's not the case this year. So these dynamics will mean a lot in this general election, I think.
Yeah, and isn't that what Rubio kind of represents? He had a rally in South Carolina with Nikki Haley, the first black senator since Reconstruction in the South. And like one white guy with him on stage, kind of representing the new Republican politics. But I think his policies and his rhetoric still haven't quite caught up. If he really wants to appeal to a broader demographic, they still seem far right to a lot of people.
Right. Tara, and then jump over to Gene.
I definitely think that this is going to be a fascinating election year. And I think the idea of it going back to 1860 is utterly alarming.
But could happen.
Yeah, but what captures my attention the most is the fact that so much seems to be in flux. Like, it was Michael Scott they called, right? Like
Michael Scott.
Yeah, like Michael Scott was saying that, you know, it's a time that could very potentially be a hopeful one, where you see all those kind of paradigmatic shifts happening, maybe shifts that work to close the various gaps that kind of demarcate American society. And yet, I guess I'm not nearly as hopeful that things will be remedied. I think we are in the midst of something that feels very chaotic, whether you are Democrat or Republican, and I'm not quite sure that there's a clear sense of what that resolution will be, and if it can happen without conflict.
I agree. You know, we are in a sense of pure chaos when it comes to this political revolution that's taking place on both sides of the aisle. To the point about Rubio the new emerging Republican Party, I do think that, you know, as an insider, you know, you're going to be seeing a party that's open to demographics that it hasn't reached out, typically reached out to before. I do think Marco Rubio does represent something new, fresh for the party, and I'm interested to see where it goes.
So just a partisan question here for a moment. Just excuse me, guys. So is that where you're leaning now, that your boy is out of the race?
Well, personally, I'll tell you this. You know, I said before on the air, the issue that matters to me, my number one issue is criminal justice reform and this cycle. And looking at my side of the aisle, it comes down to two folk, Rubio and Kasich. And I'm watching intently at both to see which way I'm going to lean come April 26th.
I hear you. And I think that's an interesting discussion. I mean, one of the discussions we'd like to have when we get to Cleveland is just that, is race in the future of the Republican Party and what that says about conservatism in America and more. The volatility of this moment, I think we'll see a lot more coming this week, right? Saturday is the South Carolina primary?
Thursday.
I think our next debate is Thursday. I think our next debate is Thursday. And I want to say Nevada is Saturday for us.
Right, that's for you. Yeah. And then the public. Yeah. Right. And that'll be really telling. And then comes the
It's Saturday is the South Carolina Democratic primary.
Right, that's what I thought. Right.
Which is expected to go to Clinton. The black vote is supposed to go to expected to go to Clinton, which will give her the expected decisive victory. South Carolina,
and we'll see where that goes. Interesting. This means nothing at all, other than a personal note. But Jolene Ivey, former delegate who ran for lieutenant governor, posted on her Facebook page over the weekend. I saw this. I am working for Hillary Clinton, but my kids are all voting for Sanders.
In Nevada, he got 82% of the voters under 30. So. Yeah.
Right. So this is – we'll see where all this goes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This has been great. Great to have you in the studio, Jessel. Jessel Knorr is reporter and producer for the Real News Network. Been doing some incredible work around the country and here in Baltimore. You should check out what he's been doing, and we'll be linking to some of it. Dr. Tara Bynum is postdoctoral fellow in English department at Rutgers University. Eugene Craig III, grassroots activist and third vice chair of the State Republican Party.
A quick shout out.
Like 10 seconds.
We'll give a quick birthday shout out to Caitlin Martin, good friend. Happy 27th birthday.
All right. And we'll be coming right back with Joshua Harris. Joshua Harris, who was running to become the Democratic nominee for the mayor's race in Baltimore, now has switched to green. He'll be joining us next. Stay with us.